Even though our speakers are no strangers to us, I want to give them a formal introduction. One reason I'm doing that is for our website, because we post on audio and video these lessons, and Michelle makes sure that she has the introductions there so that people from out of our area who might click on that, and that happens a lot more than you might think, will know things about people. J.D. Conley was born in El Paso, Texas in 1959. He is a third-generation gospel preacher and is in his 23rd year of full-time preaching. He preached his first sermon in La Rose, Louisiana at age 15. He majored in Bible at Freed Harbor University and is a graduate of the Brown Trail School of Preaching in Fort Worth, Texas. He is now in his 12th year working with the Harmer Hill Church of Christ in Marietta, Ohio, where he also serves as one of the elders. He has been married to the former Denise Cooper for 36 years. They have 6 children and 5 grandchildren. Their son, Shane, preaches in Guthrie, Kentucky. J.D. is no stranger to us. He always does an excellent job. He gave a graduation speech a couple of years ago that we put in tract form and use it at our displays wherever we go. He graciously gave us permission to do that. He has a way with words. He has a very good, what's that long list of words somebody knows? Vocabulary. Yeah, that's it. Vocabulary. I need a DJ's help on that. And he has a very good vocabulary. We're thankful for JD being here with us today.
Thank you, Andy, for those kind words. I appreciate so very much the invitation to come and be on this lectureship. It's kind of a odd situation because this is the first time Denise and I have been in this facility and at the school since the passing of Brother Denver back in February. And for many years, he would introduce me before I spoke on this lectureship, and I even missed some of those introductions, not all of them. I remember the one from 1999 vividly, though. It was short and to the point. My topic that year was euthanasia. He came to this podium and said, JD's topic for this hour is euthanasia, and then he leaned into this microphone and said, I hope he's against it. And then turned around and walked off. I didn't have a comeback for that then, and I don't have a comeback for that now. Thank you, Andy, and the lectureship committee and the elders for the invitation to speak at this hour. And I want to commend you for your selection of this year's theme, Enlarging My Faith, Eliminating My Fears. Perhaps as never before, we as Christians need our faith enlarged, and we need our fears eliminated. We are living in an ever-increasing, frightening time, a time when we need our faith to be stronger than ever before, and our spirit to be infused with undaunted courage. I also appreciate the lead-in statement for each assignment, because for years now I have found that when I study the Psalms, they are a limitless source of strength and courage to my spiritual life. And each time I consult these holy leaves, I leave to enter back into the fray with my faith and courage fortified, and my resolve to live for Christ more determined. My assignment for this hour is when I study the Psalms, God gives me justice, taken from Psalm 140. Let's perform a perusal of Psalm 140. Most scholars believe that this psalm was composed during the early life of David, when he was doggedly pursued by Saul. These 13 verses are a stark reminder of three facts, two of which are very calming and reassuring. However, the first of these three is unsettling. and most disturbing, which is the deeply entrenched and widely dispersed reality of human depravity. Not the Calvinistic brand, but the depravity brought about by the individual choice to commit sin. And this psalm begins by setting forth that David was an eyewitness to this undeniable truth. But the last two facts borne out in this psalm declare some wonderful things. God is present, and he is always just and fair in his dealings with people. Not only his people, but all people, including his enemies. Therefore, when I read the Psalms, including this one and others, I can confidently say God gives me justice, but I'm happy to report this afternoon it's mercy, or it's justice tempered with mercy. Else I would not be here, and neither would you. How grateful we should be that God hath not dealt with us after our sins, nor has rewarded us according to our iniquities. Psalm 103 and verse 10. Let's now turn our attention to the text. The first fact, as I pointed out a moment ago, is disturbing, which is simply this: the ever-present enemy, verses 1 through 5. Deliver me, O Lord, from the evil man. Preserve me from the violent man, which imagine mischiefs in their heart. Continually are they gathered together for war. They have sharpened their tongues like a serpent. Adder's poison is under their lips. Selah. Keep me, O Lord, from the hands of the wicked. Preserve me from the violent man who have purposed to overthrow my goings. The proud have hid a snare for me and cords. They have spread a net by the wayside. They have set gins for me. Selah. Now I want you to consider how much more terrifying and frightful these verses would be without the knowledge of a just God who is in control. This section not only informs us of wicked and violent men, but it also tells us they are proactive in their wickedness and designing in their violence, taking their cues from the God of the nether region. And while it is true Satan is not omnipresent, he is nonetheless traversing the earth. He is constantly on the prowl, tirelessly walking back and forth, up and down. He is busy, brethren, and he is working double overtime. And likewise, his minions follow his lead. And this is why the wary David cries out in verse 1, deliver me, O Lord, from the evil man. Preserve me from the violent man. This plea of David's conveys that our ever-present enemy is persistent. Most enemies of God's people are. They are never content to leave the righteous alone. In fact, they don't even need a reason to berate and assault the righteous. In the Psalms, it is repeated time and again that our enemies will hate us and hurt us without a cause. If ever a phrase in the Bible demands God's justice, this is one. David pleads, deliver me, O Lord. Question, if God is unjust, why would David implore him for deliverance? Why go to the trouble to supplicate if God is not just? Does not this plea of David imply God's justice? Does not his second request for preservation imply the same? And furthermore, since David's foes are also God's foes, does that not lend gravitas to both of David's pleas being answered in the divine affirmative? This means that God's justice is necessarily implied in the first verse. David continues in verse 2, which imagine mischiefs in their heart, continually are they gathered together for war. This shows us that our ever-present enemy is plotting. And plural are the plots. David recognizes he has multiple adversaries beyond the evil and violent individual of verse 1. They too are engaged in the nefarious activities of formulating plans by which war and discomfort can be brought against the man after God's own heart. Not only are their plots numerous, but there is cohesion between the plotters. They are united and organized in toppling the sweet singer of Israel. And though David feels threatened, he remains steadfast. He is absolutely convinced that his just God will deliver and preserve him from every shady scheme. Christians have many plotting against them today, and not just those that adhere to the teachings of the Quran or march under the banner of ISIS. Some of them sit in seats of power in Washington. It seems almost every day verdicts are handed down, laws are made, rules are enforced, wrongful rights are granted, and rightful rights are stripped away, none of which square with God's law. And this in turn causes us to feel much like David felt. Nevertheless, let us think like David, who said, "Plead my cause, O Lord, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me." Psalm 35 and verse 1. The 35th Psalm shows that David believed God's justice would intervene and bring about victory. David's faith in God's justice assures me that when I read the Psalms, God gives me justice. Verse 3. They have sharpened their tongues like a serpent. Adder's poison is under their lips, Selah. And this declares that our ever-present enemy is poisonous. The enemies of God have the capability to engage in character assassination. And David acknowledges they have sharpened their tongues like a serpent. Just as a venomous snake carries poison in its mouth, the mouths of people carry a poison all its own in that little member that we call the tongue. James says it is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison, James chapter 3 and verse 8. And down through the annals of time, God's people have been slandered and cursed, and we have been wrongfully accused and convicted by ad hominem attacks. The Lord's church has been smeared and grossly misrepresented. Christians are poisoned in the press and besmirched on social media. God's holy word is scorned and spat upon daily. And if you call yourself a Christian, you are immediately labeled as a crazed, wild-eyed zealot, intolerant, hateful, narrow-minded, self-righteous, homophobic, hopelessly out of touch, ignoramus. And you have little right to draw breath, much less express your faith in Jesus Christ. And all of these injustices and more are heaped upon us. We are under fire from all sides. But when I read the Psalms, the serpent's tooth is dulled. The poison is not as potent because God gives me justice. He injects me with strength to endure whatever insults and injuries are hurled my way. And through his amazing providence, he may be shielding me from barbed tongues that would pierce me through and poison me. I derive great comfort knowing our God shall come and shall not keep silence, Psalm 50 and verse 3. My faith in his justice is fortified in reading the Lord, for he cometh to judge the earth. He shall judge the world with righteousness and the people with his truth, Psalm 96 and verse 13. His justice cannot be denied, nor his will circumvented, because he shall judge the world and the people with equity, Psalm 98 and verse 9. The end of verse 3 is marked by the Selah, the first of three in this brief psalm. This is a significant word. It is an important word. It is used a total of 74 times in the Bible, 71 times in Psalms, and 3 times in the 3rd chapter of the book of Habakkuk. And it should not be left unread when it appears. Selah is a musical notation. More exact, it's a musical pause. And it is inserted into the psalm for the purpose of meditating over what has just been prayed or sung. Some have likened it to amen or hallelujah. Adam Clark affirms that Selah means this is the truth. The meaning of Selah has also been compared to the Lord's admonition, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear. So with that understanding of Selah, what is the inspired David warning the reader to pause and ponder over? What does he want us to embrace as truth? Would it not be the fact that even though our enemy is ever present, so is our God, a God of justice? That even though diabolical plans are devised against us, we can depend on God for deliverance and preservation because he is a God who renders justice. Certainly, this is a truth over which we should pause and gratefully meditate. Verse 4, keep me, O Lord, from the hands of the wicked. Preserve me from the violent man who have purposed to overthrow my goings. This verse declares that our ever-present enemy is purposeful. David knew that headstrong Saul and his aides concocted definite ploys to overthrow his godly intentions. And those who wield power very often fulfill their evil desires. When the powerful devise ways to afflict and eliminate the righteous, a resounding cry for God's justice should ascend from our hearts and from our lips. By and large, as a general rule, through his just ways, God will see to it that his people are kept out of the hands of the wicked and preserved from violence. But this does not mean that we have a firewall of protection, that nothing bad will ever happen to us, that our enemies will never hurt us, that we're bulletproof. David knew this better than anybody. Job's protective hedge was chopped down. The prophets were tortured. James was beheaded. Stephen was stoned. The apostles died for the faith. Christians were persecuted, thrown in prison, thrown to the lions. And it's interesting that Jesus said, in the context of the righteous being persecuted, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and the unjust. Solomon wrote in the book of Ecclesiastes, but time and chance happen to all men. So yes, indeed, bad things happen even to the best of people. We were all grieved all across this brotherhood over the murder of our sister in Christ, Roberta Edwards, a few weeks ago in Haiti. a Christian lady who had devoted her life to taking care of orphaned children. Can God be charged with injustice over that tragedy? No, of course not. Why? Because Roberta is now in Abraham's bosom and is greatly blessed. God has not been unjust or unfair or unfaithful to us when bad things happen to us. When I was about 15 years old, my dad told me something that I've never forgotten. He said, "You know, it really doesn't matter how you die. If it's from old age, disease, or accident, or even murder, we all have to die. What matters is if we are ready to meet God when we die. Christians, if they are faithful, will always be ready to meet God, and we can know that our God will be just and merciful." So yes, sometimes bad things, tragic things happen to good people, things that our finite minds cannot understand. But that does not mean that God has been unjust or uncaring, or that the perpetrators of evil will enjoy impunity. They won't. God's justice will be meted out, if not in this life, in the one to come. But the overall nature of God is to preserve and protect his people. And furthermore, brethren, think about this. We have no way of knowing how many times God has preserved us and has protected us from tragedy without us ever being remotely aware of it. Perhaps when we get to heaven, God will reveal that information to us. Let me suggest one way in which evil coming upon the righteous can be reduced. Even though God is just and equitable, the righteous nonetheless must implore him to exact justice. Notice that David did not expect God to protect him from wickedness and violence without first asking him. Instead, David asks, and he is specific in his request. "Keep me from the hands of the wicked, preserve me from the violent man." Just as our enemies are purposeful, so must we purposely ask God for his help. Jesus commands, "Ask, and it shall be given thee. For everyone that asketh receiveth. How much more shall your Father which is in heaven give good things to them that ask him?" I'm afraid sometimes our prayers are too generic. Instead of being specific, we generalize, and I think there's a reason for that. Because we acknowledge God as being omniscient, and perhaps we rely on that a little bit too much in our prayers, and we allow our prayers to be less thoughtful, less specific, not as deliberate. Now, could it be, and this is only a suggestion, it's not an affirmation, could it be that the presence of so much injustice in the world is partially due to the righteous not being more specific in their requests to God? Because over in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 6, we are plainly told, "But in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God." Now couple that with what James said about prayer. "You ask and receive not, because you ask amiss." James chapter 4 and verse 3. Our prayers are to have a pointed purpose, And that purpose should be that God's justice be exacted upon evil people and their devices by name, when that's possible, that plague this earth. Now, please don't confuse this with a cry for vengeance. Vengeance is God's affair, Romans 12 and verse 19. God's people do not ask and pray for retaliation. We turn the other cheek, but at the same time, we sigh, do we not, for justice, simply for what is fair and right? And since God is just, we're content to leave it all in His holy hands. Verse 5. The proud have hid a snare for me and cords. They have spread a net by the wayside. They have set gins for me, Selah. Our ever-present enemy upon whom we seek God's justice is prideful. Their pride has filled them up to such a degree that they have complete confidence in the ploys that they have devised. They are proud of the traps that they have set. They are absolutely sure that their plans to trip the feet of the righteous are going to be met with success. And though God's people are warned not to be ignorant of the devil's devices, that does not mean it's impossible for us to be ensnared. May we walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Now notice that the word is gins, not grins. And I say this because in the 2010 edition of the King James Version Bible published by Hendrickson and printed in China, this typographical error was made. And by the way, this edition also contains other mistakes in spelling, so if you have a copy of that particular edition, read it cautiously. Now, while it is true that the enemies of God's people no doubt grin and sneer and laugh when the righteous fall prey to their traps, grins is not the word used here. And I quote from Gray and Adams, who say, gins, the word gin is a contraction of engine. So refers generally to mechanical instruments. Here it means a contrivance to ensnare, a trap. The secrecy and the stealth our enemies employ impress upon us our need for God's constant guidance and protection. And the inspired Selah is used again, denoting our need for careful thought concerning the harrowing truth set forth in verses 4 and 5. May we implore our just God for a swift reversal of schemes, urging Him to let the wicked fall into their own nets, whilst that I withal escape. Psalm 141 and verse 10. May our faith be enlarged and our fears eliminated when we read elsewhere in this glorious book, the Lord preserveth the faithful and plentifully rewardeth the proud doer. Psalm 31:23. So once more, I am reassured that when I read the Psalms, God gives me justice. And although the truth about the ever-present enemy is troublesome, it is counterblasted in the balance of this psalm by not one, but two faith-enlarging, fear-eliminating facts. The first of which is the ever-present Elohim in verses 6 through 11. Now, although the terms God and Lord in these verses are translated respectfully from the Hebrew words Yahweh and Adonai and not Elohim, which is the Hebrew plural for the Godhead, for alliteration's sake, I suffer your permission to use Elohim, though it is not specifically used in this particular text. Its use does not diminish or impugn God's omnipresence. After all, God the Lord is integral to Elohim. Verse 6, I said unto the Lord, Thou art my God, hear the voice of my supplications, O Lord. These words assure us that our ever-present God is personal. Brethren, this one verse refutes the doctrine of deism, which purports that God is aloof, that he is remote, he is unconcerned about man. And as a result, the deist rejects belief in an omnipresent and intimate God. And yet David writes, I said unto the Lord. Now obviously this denotes human proximity to deity. And furthermore, David states, thou art my God. So not only is God nearby, David lays claim to him. And the verse ends with David's request that God hear his fervent prayer. Since God is personal, he is positioned and inclined to come to our aid, dispensing justice as he sees fit. Verse 7. O God the Lord, the strength of my salvation, thou hast covered my head in the day of battle. This verse sets forth that the omnipresent God is protective. Only a personal God would offer protection to his own, and only an omnipresent God could do that. How fair would it be of God, who has told us in this book that he is our refuge and strength, a very present help in time of trouble, if he deserted us when we needed him the most? He plainly tells us, call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver thee. Psalm 50 and verse 15. Far too many put their trust in human devised modes of protection. And yet the faith-filled child of God knows that in time of peace or unrest, except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. Psalm 127 and verse 1. David added, thou hast beset me behind and before and laid thine hand upon me. Psalm 139 and verse 5. Knowledge of our Father's protective barrier and his constant watch care over us. Oh, that should enlarge our faith and obliterate our fears. Verse 8. Grant not, O Lord, the desires of the wicked. Further not his wicked device, lest they exalt themselves, Selah. This verse declares that our ever-present, ever-just God is preemptive. David is praying for something here that Christians rarely do, which is the failure of the wicked. How often do Christians pray, either publicly or privately, for the wicked to fail? I don't hear it prayed publicly. Why is it rarely done, especially in this day and time? If it was proper and good for David to pray for this, why not us? And even though God is unlimited in his power and can prevent and preclude evil plans, he nonetheless expects us to pray to him in order to bring about the failure of the wicked. As we saw in verse 4, prayer plays a vital role in the collapse of evil plans. James says, the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. But how righteous are we if we fail to pray for the defeat of evil purposes? Furthermore, why should we expect the wicked to fail when we don't ask God for them to fail? But our goal is not just for the wicked to fail, but that after they fail, they will abandon their wicked ways and seek to do better, even turn to Christ and obey the gospel. May we understand that by praying for their failure, we're also praying for their conversion. The final appearance of the Selah in this psalm underscores the importance of praying in this fashion. The world is rife with violence, both premeditated and random. School shootings, theater shootings, the senseless murder of law enforcement officers has been called the new normal. Oh, I pray it is not. God's people must believe that the preemptive power of the ever-present God is at hand. And we must beckon him and plead with him to foil the plans of evil people. He will hear us in the day of trouble. Psalm 20 and verse 1. When I read the Psalms, I know God will render his justice. Verse 9, as for the head of those that compass me about, let the mischief of their own lips cover them. Our ever-present God is permissive. Only an all-loving God would grant the apex of his creation the freedom of choice. And odd as it might sound, evil exists not because God doesn't, but because he does. Now, this does not mean that God is the origin of evil or that he in any way condones it. His divine wrath will be meted out in response to it, Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. His justice requires it, Romans 11 and verse 22. But consider how unloving and senseless it would have been for God to create a robotic race. We'd all be androids programmed to blithely and merrily obey apart from any individual will or choice. But our just and loving God did not do that. Instead, and much to our delight, he created us with free will. And how unfortunate that every person who has ever lived and has been granted that free will has chosen to sin. Sin, evil, is in the world as a result of the misuse of our God-given free moral agency. The atheistic assertion that God does not exist because evil exists crumbles. Although God bestows free will upon us, each member of the human race, this is not the kind of permissiveness verse 9 is conveying. Rather, the permissiveness depicted here refers to God's allowance of his enemies, our enemies, to have a taste of their own medicine. In other words, duly divine justice. When I read this verse and others from the Psalms, such as his mischief shall return upon his own head and his violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate, Psalm 7:16, I can know that God will give me and all his children justice. Like what Harris said, evil is a boomerang returning with added force upon the evildoer. Please understand that God's justice is not meted out by means of a tit-for-tat process. No, the wicked will get more in repayment than they originally dished out. They might surround us and hurl insults at us, but the fruit of their lips will return at gale force and bury them. Verse 10, let burning coals fall upon them. Let them be cast into the fire, into deep pits, that they rise not up again. This verse 2 shows us that our just and ever-present God is punitive. Justice requires punishment. Otherwise, it's not justice. It is a punishment that cannot be avoided. And it is gravely severe. Hell, the eternal fiery abode of the condemned, is depicted in similar terms that David uses here. John in the Revelation speaks of a lake of fire and brimstone. Likewise, David speaks of burning coals and fiery pits from which there is no escape. Though God, David, nor we are willing that any should perish, eternal ruin will be the lot of every soul that refuses to repent and obey the Christ. And it will be their own fault. The heathen are sunk down in the pit they have made. In the net which they hid is their own foot taken, Psalm 9 and verse 15. God's justice demands punishment for sin. And when I read the Psalms, I'm reminded that God gives the righteous and wicked alike justice. Verse 11, let not an evil speaker be established in the earth. Evil shall hunt the violent man to overthrow him. Our great omnipresent God is powerful. He pursues, pummels, and puts out of service the violent man. But there are myriads of evil speakers and violent men upon the earth. Is God to be blamed for this? Certainly not, because that would make him unjust. Man alone is responsible for his sin and its consequences, and it is the consequences for man's sin where God's justice comes into being. Once more, this is where the vital need for prayer should be recognized. With a heartfelt, "Let not," David pleads with God. May we take this page out of the Psalms and apply it to our daily prayer life. If we would but fervently pray, "Let not, deliver me, preserve me, keep me, hear me, grant not," as this psalm teaches, would there not be less evil in the world today? It's through prayer that we tap into God's power to change the world. And through prayer, may we take full advantage of the power that we have at our disposal to put the evil and violent man out of commission. And finally, when I read the Psalms, I'm assured that God gives me justice because he is the ever-present exactor, verses 12 and 13. In verses 6 through 11, God's justice is implicitly set forth. In the last two verses, his justice is explicitly declared. I know that the Lord will maintain the cause of the afflicted and the right of the poor. Most assuredly, God, the ever-present exactor, is pitiful. How comforting to know that God is with us when we are afflicted, and that he will sustain us. The judge of all the earth will see to it that fair judgment is rendered to the poor. And David leaves no room for quibble, boldly stating, I know that the Lord will. We too can have rock solid faith in the equity and fairness of God. Rest easy. The Lord will defend us. If God be for us, who can be against us? The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. And who is he that will harm you if ye be followers of that which is good? 1 Peter 3, 9, 12, and 13. And finally, verse 13, surely the righteous shall give thanks unto thy name, the upright shall dwell in thy presence. Oh, how our ever-present exactor God is precious. And once again, David is emphatic, declaring, surely the righteous shall. Shall what? Give thanks to God the Father, the exactor of justice, and dwell in his presence. How precious our Father is to bring about and make possible such hope, gratitude, and joy in a world steeped with injustice. Know this, God is always on the side of the oppressed righteous, and he is never on the side of the evil oppressor. May we ever be grateful that we serve a pitiful and precious, ever-present exactor of justice. This psalm hits hard on the themes of divine deliverance, protection, and guidance, but underneath each one of these lies God's justice. Without his justice, the deliverance, the protection, and the guidance the righteous crave could never be. Apart from heavenly justice, our faith would be eliminated and our fears would be enlarged, making the Christian life one of futility and hopelessness. But the reality and assurance of God's justice makes the Christian life the only life worth living. May we live it prayerfully, dutifully, and joyfully. And as we read the inspired, glorious collection of the Psalms, may we always be reminded of God's ever-present, ever-exacting justice. Thank you.